You're listening to EPN, the ePodcast Network.
This is Enterprise Radio and your host, Eric Dye.
Welcome to Enterprise Radio. This is Eric Dye. Enterprise Radio is your EPN channel for exclusive interviews with entrepreneurs, small business owners, top executives, and authors who have experienced great success, as well as the sharing of their latest creations, products, and/or services that can help you build your business, leading to business success. Today, we have the privilege and honor of having Matt Zeller, a United States Army veteran of the Afghan War, and also the author of the newly released book, Watches Without Time, An American Soldier in Afghanistan. Matt, certainly great to have you and an honor to have you a part of Enterprise Radio.
Oh, thank you, sir. I'm honored to be here.
Well, thank you. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your time in Afghanistan? I'm sure that's a loaded question. What you learned, or what did you learn about yourself and about our fellow troops and the Afghanis that live there? And what are we trying to do there? And have we been successful? Why or why not? I know that's a loaded question, but you get the drift.
And 30 seconds or less, right?
Yeah, well, 25. I'm kidding.
So 2008, I deployed to a place called Ghazni, Afghanistan, to serve on what was called at that point a PMT/ETT team. So PMT stands for Police Mentor Team, and then ETT is Embedded Tactical Trainer. Basically, our job was to train the Afghan Army and the Afghan police in our area to one day hopefully replace us. And we spent a couple of months before we got in the country training for that mission at Fort Riley, Kansas. And then the subsequent, you know, 9 months in Afghanistan trying to accomplish that mission. And that's what the book is about. While we were at Fort Riley, we had to participate in a funeral detail for two of the guys that we were going to replace. And it kind of really hit home amongst all of us that, you know, the Army wasn't joking when they were saying that this was one of the most dangerous missions that we could be asked to undertake. And so I wanted my wife and my family and my dearest friends to sort of potentially have what I thought might be a detailed record of the last year of my life. So I started writing this weekly email. And I got into country in April of 2008, and a couple of weeks later, I started getting packages and letters and emails from complete strangers. And so I thanked them for their kind words and their gifts, and then I started to say, "How did you find me?" And it turned out people were forwarding on my email. So long story short, about 6 months into deployment, people just started saying, "You got to turn this into a book when you get back and share it with people. People need to, you know, the American people need to hear your story." So, you know, we spent, it was a different time back then. It was a different war. You got to remember, 2008, most of the national attention from both the media and the political discussion was on Iraq, and it was on the surge in Iraq. And a lot of people, you know, they knew the Afghan war was going on, but they didn't. 2008 is kind of looked at as a turning year. That was when the war really started to pivot and go bad. And we were kind of at the brunt of that. I lived on a very small base in the middle of Ghazni. Wasn't an American base. It was actually an Afghan Army base. And we had like a little compound of about four or five buildings when we first got there that about 20 of us lived out of. Now, by the time we left, we had actually built it up so that it could handle 300 people. But when we first got there, it was small, remote, and we were pretty much on our own. My perspective of the Afghans, you know, the Afghan Army, they've been developing really well. And as I point out in my book, you know, the Afghan Army has been consistently trained by American troops and our NATO allies since 2002. And they've been trained to a proficiency performance-based standard, which is it's kind of essential to understand why things are the way they are in Afghanistan. The Afghan Army is so much more further developed than the Afghan police because when a unit goes through training, they only can get to that next level. They can only, like, be saying, okay, they've passed all these things if they demonstrate all the skills that are in that first level on their own. Like, it's not driven by time. You're not said, okay, you got 40 weeks to do this. It's whenever it gets done, that's when those guys organically get to move on. That's really important because the Afghan police from 2002 to 2006 were actually trained by the Germans exclusively. There's this weird part of international law that says foreign militaries actually can't train foreign police forces to do foreign like police work, which is some weird cause of the Geneva Convention. So the Germans actually brought in civilian advisors, police officers from Germany, to train the Afghan police. And they were charged with training about 80,000 guys, and they got about 600 trained. Now, it's not to say that the Germans only focused on 600 guys. It is that the German standards were to a cop you could then send out and walk the beat in Berlin. Afghanistan doesn't even have a functioning phone system, so there's no 911 ability. You can't just pick up the phone and call the police. So you got to kind of look at the Afghan cops as more of a paramilitary force. So in 2007, the State Department said, all right, Germans, you're done training the Afghan police. We're going to contract it out to a company called DynCorp. And they took all 80,000 guys and they sent them through a two-week basic training program, which obviously didn't work. So in 2007, NATO stepped in and said, all right, we're going to train the Afghan police to basically be a paramilitary force, almost an additional army. But we're also going to link up with DynCorp, and when it actually comes to doing the actual nitty-gritty police work that we hope they'll one day do, that's where DynCorp is supposed to stand in. So that kicked off late 07. We were at the forefront in 2008. And I got to tell you, you know, working with the Afghan Army guys, those guys would go out and they could accomplish their mission. They could go take territory. They could defend themselves. They, you know, could sort of aim. But they were super aggressive. If the Taliban tried to attack us with the Afghan Army, I actually felt bad for the Taliban at times because the Afghan Army guys really liked to fight. The Afghan cops, completely different thing. These guys would sell their weapon the minute you gave it to them. would desert, you know, within a day or two of joining the force. We would spend most of our time teaching these guys basic hygiene. Two completely different forces, but you got other people. I think the American people, and that's why I think the book is so important, is that year was so critical because that's when the war started to really get violent and the Taliban really resurged themselves and kind of took the war back away from what had been a sort of a low-intensity conflict and made it much more national in scale. And if the American people, you know, think about what's the future of Afghanistan, we've committed ourselves to a substantial period of time, at least 10 years, of training the Afghan security forces. That's both the Army and the police. And we're looking to the police to do domestic stability, and they're just not there yet.
Now, you decided to write a book about your experiences in Afghanistan. Now, you had mentioned that you were prompted by folks as they read some of your material. Now, did you ever get the idea to write a book before you were prompted by others, or was it inside of you, everything you were seeing, it was a no-brainer that you should put it in print?
It was after folks started writing me, because the stories I was writing back, you know, they weren't filtered by the Army. I wasn't publicizing them. They were just my personal emails that were getting forwarded. And people were saying, we're not getting this press coverage. We're not getting these types of stories. I mean, my unit did over 400 combat missions in the 9 brief months that we were there. We were out constantly. And unlike a lot of American units at the time, who basically we didn't have a large presence in Afghanistan at this point. I mean, we're talking, I think at most 40,000 troops, U.S. troops in Afghanistan at that point. Right now we have 100,000. To give you a perspective, the area of Afghanistan that we were responsible for training in is the size of West Virginia. And at that time, there were a total of about 800 American soldiers to try and literally patrol, conduct operations, train the Afghans, do humanitarian projects, and 800 guys for the size of a place like West Virginia with mountains that go up to 16, 17,000 feet. To put it in perspective, right now, that same territory has about 6,000 to 7,000 Americans in it. So that's how much we've sort of doubled down on our efforts in Afghanistan. But taking it back then, these stories weren't getting out. And because we were a unit that lived with Afghans and went with the Afghans wherever they went, you know, it's their country, and they're very proud about taking care of their – they think of us as visitors I think you asked me originally, what was one of the things I learned? I learned people all over the planet are people. At the end of the day, an Afghan parent has the same wants and desires for their children as an American parent. And Afghans are very proud about their country. They're very proud about their history. And they're very proud about this culture of taking care of visitors. And they look at us as visitors in their country who they're honor bound to take care of. That was, for me, a really interesting learning lesson was that it wasn't just this mythic enemy. The Afghan people themselves were actually really great people. The problem is that the Afghan government itself is absolutely horrible at taking care of its people, to the extent that it actually alienates others to joining the Taliban. I mean, there's so much rampant corruption. There's so much things that the Afghan government just gets wrong that results in somebody just having almost no sense of hope other than joining the Taliban to express their grievance, that they're taken up by this movement for what usually is a local cause. They're pissed off about something in their area, and they join up with a national level insurgency. That to us was fascinating. But, it was these stories. We were out constantly, and it was, I got blown up on my 14th day in country, and worst day of my life. We call it, in the military, you call it your alive day, and mine's April 28th. And the chapter in the book's called MRAP Down, and it's a whole story about how, it's the story about how the patrol of 15 of us ended up getting surrounded at one point by 45 members of the Taliban, and for about an hour, it was 45 of them versus 15 of us. And it was all because we were trying to protect a vehicle that we had just had blown up by an IED. And that type of – people didn't realize that Afghanistan was that rampantly violent. I mean, I remember going home on leave, stopping in Kuwait, and this was at the end of 2008 because my leave was towards the end of my tour. And I remember guys who were rotating out of Iraq who were telling me that Iraq had basically died down. There wasn't that much violence. And they were wondering what it was like to be in Afghanistan. Because they're like, well, what's it like to face an enemy that stands up and shoots back at you? And it was so mind-boggling to have guys, because we thought Iraq was the violent war, and we got to Afghanistan. It was a rude wake-up call.
Certainly sounds like it. Now, if we could do things differently in Afghanistan, what would you advise or suggest that our military do there, and how long do we need to stay there? Can Afghanistan handle its own security?
Well, that's a great question. I think the Afghan army, their biggest issue right now is equipping themselves. I mean, one of the big questions we should be asking ourselves is, how much gasoline does the Afghan army have? And I know that's really simplistic, but It's a war in which you drive to the fight, right? And they drive around in basically pickup trucks or old Hummers that we've given them. And from my experience, we were just giving them their gasoline. And if that's still the case, I've got to wonder how many days it is before after our departure where they would just outright run out of gasoline. So logistically speaking, I don't think the Afghan military can handle themselves, and they're definitely going to depend on foreign assistance for at least the next couple of years. What could we do differently? The thing about this is that it's a thinking man's war. A lot of people have discounted this whole idea of counterinsurgency not to be a success because not more violent. And the problem is twofold. One, the counterinsurgency that was developed for the Army's field manual and employed with success is based on an urban population that's literate. The Afghan population is remarkably illiterate. I mean, we're talking a literacy rate that hovers in some places in the single digits, and I don't think above 30% nationally. We're talking about when you're trying to train guys how to just shoot, and you have your source material as PowerPoint presentations. Most of the guys in the room can't even read, even if it's in their language, they can't read it. So you've got to do everything verbally. And it has to be basically, visually instructed. So I think the thing that we could do is adapt to counterinsurgency to focus on a rural cultural based society, because that's Afghanistan almost writ large. And then the other thing is, we almost need two armies. We need, you know, the 82nd Airborne is phenomenal at taking territory and killing the enemy. And the bulk of the U.S. Army is phenomenal at doing that. But to ask a 19-year-old infantry soldier who's been trained their whole life to kill the enemy, seize and take territory, to then the next day be concerned with whether or not trash is getting picked up on time or the cops aren't beating people up or wells need to be dug, I mean, that's a lot for a guy to take in. And mentally, you know, you need to get there is a different place you get yourself into when you're in a combat fight. And to try to then switch that off and go right into, you know, hand out the water to the children mode, not everybody can do that. And the best guys I've seen are the special forces. I mean, they're by far the best ones at it. We almost need like a cadre of folks who come in after militarily defeated an enemy on the battlefield to come in and really help that next peacekeeping stage, that next post-conflict stage. That was sort of the biggest takeaway for me in Afghanistan, was that, you know, we might not have wanted to do nation building, but the Afghans do. And if the Afghans want to make their country something viable that is not going to, you know, rehouse the Taliban or Al-Qaeda in the future, it's going to have to be something that develops. And that means that nation building has to be a part of it. And it's something you can't avoid.
Today we have the privilege of joining us today is Matt Zeller, United States Army veteran of the Afghan War and also author of the newly released book, Watches Without Time, an American soldier in Afghanistan, here on Enterprise Radio, a part of the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. Now, Matt, there are three things that you hope your readers learn after they read your book, Watches Without Time. What are those?
Okay, so the first thing, I say this right in the intro, is I hope after reading this book that people realize what it means for somebody, an American son or daughter, to deploy to war. That was the biggest takeaway. I kept talking about, you know, the strangers who'd write me, they'd write back and say, I never knew it was like this. I touch on everything from training, barracks life, you know, the just how important receiving a letter is sometimes downrange. I really want people to walk away that my story might not be exactly like it, but I guarantee there are aspects that are universal. The second thing is, and this is really personal, but it's also unfortunately broadly applicable. At the end of the book, I spend an epilogue talking about the war after the war. What happens after you get let off of active duty and you get dumped out into the civilian population and you've still got these instincts. As my father put it, the Army spent 2 years basically in the lead up to our deployment training you how to kill people. And because I was a reservist, you know, 5 days after we got back from the war, I was turned back into civilian life. So 2 years being trained how to think one way, drive one way down the road, respond to situations in a particular way, and then being put out into civilian society. I mean, the weirdest thing for me was driving to the supermarket and having a choice of food. Because on my base, we had a Navy cook who I'm sure never thought he'd ever end up in a landlocked country in Asia with the Army when he joined the Navy. And he had, you know, basically whatever he could buy off the local economy to cook for us. We didn't have real a lot of choices. There wasn't a soda fountain, you know, on our fob. There was bottles of water and whatever we could buy from the local Afghan market. To walk into an American supermarket, that sometimes is a you know, just a really profound experience. So that last chapter, I'll let people read it, but I get very personal. But I've also had friends of mine and complete strangers who have deployed say they responded to it, you know, very well personally. And then the third thing I'd like folks to take away from it is that ultimately this idea of the war on terror, I joined the Army right after 9/11. Like, I enlisted the first guy and saw in uniform. And then the Army felt, you know, nice enough to ask me to go and try and achieve a commissioned officer status, which I did. So I joined to fight in this war. And I joined because of the 9/11 attacks, and I wanted to go to Afghanistan. And I got there with the mindset of, all right, we're here to fight the war on terror. And what I realized was that, more importantly, we were here. What we're doing there is preventing the next attack. And the only way we're going to do that, honest to God, is preventing today's children from becoming tomorrow's Taliban and Al-Qaeda. That really is it. And the only way we can do that is teaching these kids to read. There's a whole part of the book where I talk about the importance of handing out pens and pencils. It was actually probably the most important thing we did. We went out on this one mission early on, and I asked all my guys to carry a box of pens and pencils because a special forces soldier had said, look, it's going to be the most important thing you can do. And all my guys thought it was the dumbest idea. And I just said, let's just try it once, and the stupid will never do it again. So we get out to this village, and the first thing that happens is, you know, we get out of our vehicle, they hand out some water and some food, and this kid comes running up to my medic. His name is Doc Mason. And he goes, Mister, punch, punch, which is Dari for pen, pen. And he makes this, like, writing motion on his hand. And Scott looks at me, and he goes, did you put him up to this? And I look at Scott, and I say, I've never been to this village. And I said, give me your pen. And the next thing you knew, it was just like some unknown signal that we weren't privy to went out, because every kid in the village came out, and there was this scrum for these pens and pencils. And what we found out was that, and I talk about this extensively in the book, in a better detail than I'm going to give you here, but basically the Afghan government will provide a free education for all of its kids, but what they don't provide are the writing implements to attend school. And if your mom and dad are too poor to afford a pen or a pencil, which most Afghan families actually are too poor to afford basic school supplies, they'll keep their kids home from school, which means their kids grow up illiterate. And if you grow up illiterate in that society, you can't access news, you can't read, you know, you don't get to access the marketplace of ideas on your own. So you're way more subject to the influence of rumors and the influence of people who you think are learned. And unfortunately, a lot of the people who recruit for the Taliban are these religious leaders that go into these villages, and sometimes they're the only literate guy. Sometimes they're only barely literate. But everyone looks to them for authority because of their, you know, assumed literacy. I mean, the basic case I can make for it is my interpreter, Janice, who saved my life on more occasions than I care to remember. I asked Janice at one point after a firefight, I said, why aren't you fighting on the other side? Because she's a great shot. And Janice said to me, Matt, if I fought for the Taliban, my mother would kill me. And that really shocked me. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he just laughed. And he said, you have so much to learn about Afghan culture. He said, in our culture, men cannot fight without the blessings of their mothers. And because Janice's mom was literate, she had been able to read what the Taliban put out and realized it was pure BS when it comes to Islam. And basically made it, you know, the law was passed down throughout the family. You aren't going to join the Taliban. Now, he's a Pashtun. The Pashtun ethnicity is the largest, you know, ethnic group in Afghanistan. They make up the bulk of the Taliban. And he's not fighting for them. He's served, you know, the American forces for almost 8 years now. That to me was shocking. I wish American people knew about that, because the war on terror, terrorism is a tool. It's a tool of desperate people. You can't defeat it. It's not an ideology. What you can defeat is the ideology that inspires someone to choose that as their tool. And the only way we can do that is through literacy, through the marketplace of ideas. I mean, American democracy beat communism. I'm confident it'll beat Islamic fundamentalism. We just got to get it out there. We got to make sure that these kids can access it.
Well, incredible information. Now, Matt, you break up your book into several sections. The final section called The War at Home Begins. Talk a little bit about what you mean by that, because it does sound like something that many of our troops do experience when they do return home.
Sure. So I never actually said this to a reporter. I was diagnosed with a post-traumatic stress disorder and a mild case of traumatic brain injury based on some explosions I was exposed to in the war. And so when I got back, as I said before, my dad put it best. The Army spent 2 years training you basically how to kill people. And then they took 5 days to basically process you out of active duty, and they dumped you back into the civilian world and just expected you to carry on. Some guys can do that. I had trouble readjusting. A lot of my friends have had trouble readjusting. A lot of them have turned to drinking. I turned to drinking for a while. I'm not proud of it. I finally, thankfully, have a wonderful, loving wife who basically said, you know, we're getting you the help you need. And stood by me throughout this. I wouldn't be where I am today without my wife. Hands, no question. But I'm not the only guy who's gone through that or who will go through that. And that's the biggest thing we got to realize. saying that we make a commitment to our sons and daughters when they choose to stand up and defend our country is not just when they're in the military. It's the years afterwards. I ran for Congress in 2010. And though I did not win, my platform was a strong veterans' rights platform. I want to see the VA fully funded. I've been through the VA. I've fallen through the cracks of the VA. I've had doctors, meet with me once and then never remember who I was the next time I've come in. I've seen how the system fails people, and I've also seen how it can take care of folks. But it's going to be a substantial commitment that we need to make because these people have done everything they can for us. This is the longest war in U.S. history. And there's going to be a lot of folks that, you know, unfortunately PTSD because of stuff in the media gets such a bad rap. But there's no other way of saying this. We're not all crazy. It's just we've been instructed to think a certain way. And it's now relearning how to address situations. And I would basically, if there's any veteran out there right now who is, you know, thinking to themselves that, they're depressed or whatever, go to the VA. I'll tell you right now, from my experience of the past, you know, at this point, almost four years, they have transformed themselves. And their outreach centers especially are fantastic. I would totally advocate joining an OIF, OEF, vets group, just to talk, you know, with somebody else who's been through a similar experience. That's sort of my hope. That chapter, if for anybody else, is for the other vets out there. Because I wish that, you know, I had had, if I didn't have my wife, I would have hoped that I would have had somebody writing something like that would have pushed me to get the help that I would have needed. And if I can just get one other guy into therapy and just talking to, about what they've been through and dealing with it, then that's, to me, a success. And it was worth every hour I spent writing this thing.
Well, we truly would never be able to even fathom what the vets go through in those situations, and certainly in the Afghan war. Now, where can our listeners pick up your book?
Okay, so my publisher, Just World Books, has got a great website. It's if you just go on Google and you type in Watch It Without Time, you'll see the link for it right there, justworldbooks.com. You also can get it from Amazon, barnesandnoble.com. It will be shortly available for Kindle and downloading electronically. Those are the best places. If you'd like to, you can follow me on Twitter, Matt C. Zeller at Twitter. And also I've got a public Facebook page. You can just look for it right there. And I constantly put links up for the book on that. So, those are probably the best places. Man, it's in bookstores. Check your local bookstore. It's in various college bookstores around the country. And, the more people hear about it, the more we're trying to get it out there.
Matt's been truly informative and eye-opening. He is Matt Zeller, United States Army veteran of the Afghan War and the author of the newly released book, Watches Without Time, An American Soldier in Afghanistan. And you can refer to Matt's blog at watcheswithouttime.wordpress.com. Matt, thanks so much for joining us today and sharing your heart on Enterprise Radio.
I appreciate it, sir. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome, and in our honor as well, this is Eric Dye, and you've been listening to Enterprise Radio, a part of EPN, the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. Check us out on Facebook and receive exclusive content that you certainly do not want to miss. And once again, we do thank you for tuning in.
Thanks for listening to Enterprise Radio here on EPN. For more information or to subscribe to this podcast, visit epodcastnetwork.com.
This is the ePodcast Network.